This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Science writer Bethany Brookshire has an enemy who lives in her backyard. His name is Kevin.
Kevin. His full name is, I guess you could say, Freakin' Kevin. But we call him Kevin for short.
Kevin is a gray squirrel.
To be clear, there's probably about 12 of him in the backyard. I just call all of them Kevin. And he is my mortal enemy because due to this squirrel or group of squirrels, I have not had a successful tomato garden in at least 5 years. He steals all of my tomatoes every single year.
Annoying as Kevin the tomato thief may be, Bethany says squirrels are an interesting case study in terms of our relationships with wild animals. They are everywhere now, and quite the nuisance, but squirrels weren't always this abundant in our backyards or cities.
They were actually pets. People would trap squirrels and keep them as pets, and every so often one would escape and it would make the news. There's a squirrel in Manhattan, it escaped.
Then, at the end of the 19th century, cities started creating more parks and green spaces.
And squirrels were actually brought in deliberately to urban centers and released to kind of give people a little sense of wildlife and a little bit of nature near their apartments in their urban lives. And of course, now there's plenty enough food to sustain squirrels, and they have multiplied. And now we have many, many squirrels.
So many of them that we often refer to them as pests. How did we get from cute animal with a bushy tail to vermin we loathe? Bethany gets into those kinds of questions in her new book, Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains.
We think of pests in the same way we think of weeds. Weeds are plants that are out of place. And pests are animals that are out of place. But that then begs the question, who determines what an animal's place is? And the answer to that is, we do. Pest is a very subjective term for an animal that bothers us, an animal that is doing something we don't think that animal should be doing. The animals themselves are just doing what they need to do. They're just living their lives, you know? They just happen to be eating my tomatoes. And it's my perception that turns a squirrel that other people might really love into a pest.
Bethany says we can rethink our relationships with these vilified animals. In her book, she argues that pests are often a problem of our own making, and what we call a pest or not is all about context. Take pigeons, for example. Like squirrels, they are everywhere in cities. Their poop is all over the place. We associate them with filth. But Bethany loves them. She says they are her favorite.
They highlight our own hypocrisy so well. because the reality is that every pigeon in America, every pigeon in Europe, every pigeon pretty much anywhere except the Middle East, is there because we brought it there. Because we used to value the pigeon. We domesticated the pigeon around 5,000 years ago, and we did it because pigeons are delicious. Their poop makes excellent fertilizer. And pigeons have this amazing thing they do, which is they go out from their roost every day, they eat, and then they go exactly back to where they came from. Pigeons do not get lost. So they made great food, they made great fertilizer, and they made excellent messengers. And we bred these animals and valued them for millennia. And then we developed the telephone and chemical fertilizer and chicken, and the pigeon lost its value. And it's really fascinating to see over time, as the pigeon lost its value, it continued doing what the pigeon has always done, right? It went out, it fed itself, it came back home. But now we have no use for them, and now we hate them. And it's so sad. We've built an environment that's perfect for them, right? We put out trash. We put out bird seed. We have beautiful curlicue limestone sculptures on our roofs that pigeons love to roost in. We have created an environment that is perfect for them, and we're mad that they're taking advantage.
In another example in Bethany's book, she writes about an animal that's usually hated, but is elevated to special status in a unique setting. You describe a temple in India that is home to thousands and thousands of rats. How are the rats treated there?
Yeah, so this is an interesting example of the fact that some animals that we might think of as pests, such as rats, in this case the black rat, Rattus rattus, are not pests everywhere and they're not pests to everyone. But yes, this temple, the Karni Mata Temple, it's in Deshmukh, India. So the interesting thing about this temple is that these rats, the worshippers of these rats, are not worshipping rats. They are worshipping humans that have been reincarnated into the bodies of rats. And so that's what's really fascinating, is that these rats are not seen as rats. They are not seen as pests or vermin. And when I talked to some of the worshippers at that temple, I said, oh, well, you know, does this change? What happens if you see a rat in your kitchen? And one of my sources said, oh, I hate rats in my kitchen. They're absolutely disgusting. So it's about context. The rats in the temple are not rats. They are reincarnated people. The rats in his kitchen, those are rats. And those are pests. And it shows how these animals are pests only as a matter of context.
And I'm looking at pictures and they have these bowls and they are just like sitting there and drinking what looks like milk.
It's milk, yes. So the rats receive a very special diet. It used to be that people could come, worshippers and tourists could come and feed the rats food they brought from outside the temple. But the caretakers of the rats decided that was not optimal for the rats' health. They were eating too much junk food. And so the rats now have a very special diet. They get their own homemade bread. They get bean sprouts. They get vegetables. And they drink lots of beautiful fresh milk that is brought in every single morning.
But traditionally, when we see rats, especially in a place like a kitchen or rummaging through the trash, running down the sidewalk, we feel this like instinctive disgust or this kind of recoil. We recoil from the rats.
Yeah. And it's interesting to note that that is a matter of context, right? We see rats often where we don't expect to see them. We're surprised. We see them in places that we've learned to associate with nasty things. For example, I talked with a bunch of scientists who actually study the psychology of disgust. And the idea is that the emotion of disgust evolved to protect us from these things that can make us sick. And so when we see a rat and we are disgusted, we have taken that emotion and expanded its context to an animal that we associate with sickness, that we say is pathogenic. And that makes us see them as disgusting. And in fact, we did not see rats in general as disgusting or unclean until the actual widespread proliferation of sewers, underground sewers. Before that, people did not like rats. Rats ate their crops and ate their grain. But they actually noted that rats always seemed to be really clean. And there was this idea that rats themselves did not spread disease. It was only with sewers and rats becoming coated in all sorts of unmentionable things that they became fully disgusting.
I guess rats, in the minds of many people, rats have been associated with spreading disease, with
plague.
Yeah, plague and those things.
Yes. And it's really fascinating because in my research, I found that most scientists who study plague will tell you bubonic plague is not a human disease. It is a rodent disease that happens to spill over into humans with very bad results. And that's because rats themselves do not go around biting people and spreading disease. It's spread by fleas, rat fleas, sometimes human lice, potentially human fleas. And there is some debate as to whether or not it's rat fleas themselves that caused things like the Black Death of the 14th century, or whether some of those outbreaks might have been caused by what are known as human ectoparasites, which would be human lice or human fleas. When you have large populations of people in close associations with large populations of rats, you absolutely can get disease spread, but you can get that from any other animal with which we are closely associated, including dogs, including chickens, including pigs. You know, rats are really no different.
Now, I've always heard that, you know, if you're going to have rats, you're not going to have mice. If you have mice, you're not going to have rats. Is there any truth to that?
You know, that's an interesting question. And there's some rats eat mice. They can eat mice. A rat in a fight with a mouse, the rat will win.
Yeah, that is, for sure.
There's no question. And so where you find rats, you are unlikely to find mice in that same area, right? The mice are not interested in being where rats are. That means that where you find mice, there's probably not very many rats.
Now, you got to meet, you know, rats and mice in a different setting as a researcher. So, you know, I'm wondering if we can step away from the pest narrative for a moment to think about, you know, how they became to play such an important role in research.
That was really fascinating to me because, yes, I was a scientist and I did research primarily on mice, but also sometimes on rats. And it's really fascinating because the role of rats and mice as pests is part of what allowed them to become research subjects. It is because we don't like them that we feel okay doing the things that we need to do to learn about human disease. I studied a lot of this with the man who is primarily the man who sold the lab mouse to America. His name is C.C. Little, and he's the founder of the Jackson Laboratory, which is in Maine, and which many researchers think of as the House of Mouse. They are the world's largest purveyor of laboratory mice. And he started out breeding mice from original lines, and they were breeding these mice specifically for coat color. And scientists realized, oh, coat color is genetic. We can study genetics by breeding these mice. And they began to breed them and specifically to inbreed them until the mice all had the same genes, the same DNA. And so it became clear that we could use these mice to study human disease. And Little began to market the animals to other researchers and eventually to the public. And I found it really fascinating because in one of his articles that he actually wrote for Scientific American, he said, "Do you like mice? Of course you don't." And then he talked about the use of mice as scientific models. And he was selling the mouse to the American public as a laboratory model because it's something we could use to study humans, but it was also something that we didn't care about, that we hated. And that allowed us to use these animals the way that we use them today. I like to think that they're useful because they're just human enough to not be human at all.
You take readers on a trip to go snake hunting in the Everglades. So how did snakes in the first place become such a pest that they are now being hunted?
Yeah, so the snake that I was particularly in search of for this chapter was the Burmese python, Python bivitatus. And we actually are not 100% sure how pythons first got to the Everglades. They were definitely living wild there by the late 1970s. It could have been that people got pet pythons and released them when the pythons got too big, because pythons can be extraordinarily large. They can reach about 23 feet. So people might have, you know, freaked out and released their charges. Another option is hurricanes can destroy breeding facilities for these animals, which can release them into the swamp. It's possible that there was a combination of both of these things. Regardless, the Burmese python has found the Florida Everglades a fabulous place to live. Much like many retirees, the Burmese python thinks South Florida is great. And it is now eating a lot of the native residents. There was a study that I think was in 2012 showing that the population of rabbits in the Everglades has decreased by 100%. Raccoons were, I think, 90%, and other mammals were having higher than 50% declines. Pythons are eating the Everglades out of house and home.
And so people have started to hunt them? What does that entail?
Right. So I went out with Donna Collil. She is with the South Florida Water Management District. Her full-time job, actually, is that of a python hunter. That is her job.
Bethany joined Donna for the annual Florida Python Challenge. It's a 10-day competition to catch as many Burmese pythons as possible.
And it was a fascinating experience because you go out, it's the middle of the night. You are driving a levee in the Florida Everglades, okay? You are standing on top of a moving truck. Usually it's an SUV, and there's a platform on top of the truck, and you're standing up there while the truck is driving. And there is no security on this thing. And the truck itself is covered in floodlights. And the floodlights are lighting up the ground on either side of the levee. And the goal is for the lights to illuminate snakes that are coming out to cross the road. And it was amazing to me. First of all, I highly recommend this activity. It was magical. The Everglades at night are a wonderful, beautiful place. A magical moment. But also, pythons are ridiculously hard to see. They're so hard to see. You know, they're camouflaged, and every stick kind of looks like a snake. You know, they're incredibly hard to catch. And so it's fascinating because every year you'll get, you know, 800 or more hunters signing up for this python challenge, and they will bring in a total of 300 or so snakes. Less than one snake per person, right? And there are estimated to be tens of thousands of snakes in the Everglades.
And how do you, so you catch them and then you kill them, or what happens?
Right. So I did not catch them. Donna did. She's the specialist. So she usually goes up behind it. She has the fastest hands I have ever seen. And she just whips out a hand, gets it behind the head. And, you know, for the python challenge, they usually log data, how big it is, where it was caught, things like that. They pop it in a box, and in the morning, they turn it in to event organizers. They do kill the snake. There are approved humane methods of killing the snakes.
I asked Bethany how she felt about the hunt and what motivated the snake hunters like Donna.
I was mostly just very interested to ask why, you know, why we're going in and doing this. What are we doing it for? And it was really fascinating. She's incredibly knowledgeable, and she really loves snakes. She loves native snakes who live in the Everglades, and she loves the Florida Everglades. And so she's out there removing this invasive species to preserve the Everglades that she knows, the swamp that she loves. And that's why she's doing it. And I think many of the other hunters have the same ideas in mind. And you see that a lot with a lot of invasive species removal. It's not just pythons. It's also, you know, invasive rats on islands, mice on islands, cats on islands, foxes, anywhere where humans have introduced animals that have started to, you know, cause real problems for the native fauna. You end up with conservationists faced with this dilemma. Do you kill the rats to save the seabirds? Do you kill the cats to save the native lizards? It's not a good question to ask, and it's also not a pleasant question to answer.
But it's going to be one or the other.
I mean, there are some options. So, for example, in some places, people, you know, trap, neuter, and return cats. They adopt them out. On many islands where the cats are fully feral, that is not a good option. That's really not going to save the animals that you're trying to save. In the case of rats or mice, they will often dump thousands of tons of poison on the islands in the hopes of removing the animals. There are controlled hunts. There are traps. There are also scientific experiments trying to, for example, develop genetic alterations in mice or rats that you can then introduce onto islands that will render the mice, say, sterile, so that the population of mice dies out more naturally to preserve the animals that are living there. No matter what, there's a lot of effort, time, and money put into getting rid of these animals because of the real or perceived problems that they're causing.
Bethany says climate change is often influencing or favoring the spread of different species into new territories.
Climate change is affecting drastically which animals can succeed and thrive in particular environments, right? And when animals begin to suffer from problems of climate change, we feel bad and we try to save them. Some animals are adapting and moving. So, for example, as climate change makes some areas too warm, some animals that can move easily will start moving north, right, to find cooler weather. They'll try to find higher elevations. Animals that are used to wet areas will try to find wetter areas if their area becomes dry. And what's fascinating is that we then call those animals climate refugees, right? If they're native animals and they're moving somewhere else, we call them climate refugees. If they're an animal that we've introduced and they're succeeding in part due to climate change,
mm-hmm.
we call them pests.
Yeah.
And the difference is that we wanted one of them and we didn't want the other one. But yes, climate change is only going to change which animals thrive where and how. It introduces another kind of chaos element into how ecosystems function. It brings ecosystems into further stress where animals that we introduce can often outcompete other native fauna that might otherwise have managed to make it.
What do you want people to take away from reading your book? What is the one big message that you hope people will get after they read your book?
I would say it's in two parts. The first is that pests are a matter of perspective. We create every single pest we have because pests are about what we want and what we believe about our environments. And the second part of that is that we don't have to live this way. We created pests. We can destroy them too. And we don't need to destroy them by going out and killing them all. We can change what we call pests by changing our perspective, by changing the way we live with these animals. Do we really need to eradicate all the pigeons? Or do we need to change how we deal with our trash? Do we need to go poisoning rats? Or do we need to change our sanitation? When we have problems with animals, we're very quick to blame the animal. But we could also look to our own behavior and change how we think and how we act.
Bethany Brookshire is a science writer. Her new book is called Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains.